The reading tonight is from Exodus 33 and can be found on page 92 of the Bibles, which you should have on the chairs. That's Exodus 33 on page 92, and I'm going to read verses 1 to 6. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Leave this place, you and the people you brought up out of Egypt, and go up to the land I promised on oath to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, I will give it to your descendants. I will send an angel before you and drive out the Canaanites, Amorites, Hittites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. Go up to the land flowing with milk and honey. But I will not go with you, because you are a stiff-necked people, and I might destroy you on the way." When the people heard these distressing words, they began to mourn, and no one put on any ornaments. For the Lord had said to Moses, "Tell the Israelites, you are a stiff-necked people. If I were to go with you, even for a moment, I might destroy you. Now take off your ornaments, and I will decide what to do with you." So the Israelites stripped off their ornaments at Mount Horeb.
Annabelle, thank you very much indeed. Well, now, whether we're an old hand or a novice, when we come to studying God's words in the Bible, we regularly find our ideas about God and his world get challenged when we come to his words in the Bible. Certainly that was the case when I first started to study the Bible seriously at the age of 18. To be honest, I thought I knew enough about God and the way he operated. I had my opinions, they were pretty fixed, and I thought it was all fairly cut and dried between him and me. Of course, when we stop and think about it, it's inevitable, isn't it? After all, if my teenage and primary school ideas about God were not challenged, at least a touch by God when I came to his words, then he wouldn't be much of a God, would he? And verse 3 of our reading this evening, and it's worth having it open on page 92, verse 3, I think, challenges the whole religious mindset of our late 20th century society. Let me read it again for us. "Go up to the land flowing with milk and honey, but I will not go with you, because you're a stiff-necked people and I might destroy you on the way." See, the general impression we get from our society today is that God really is with all of us all the time. Certainly it doesn't matter what our attitude has been towards him during our brief time on this earth. When it comes to our death and to our meeting our Maker, or when it comes to a big problem or a work crisis or an obstacle in life, say a career interview or a life-threatening disease or even an exam, well, that's what God's there for. He's with us. He's on hand, ready to step in and help, rather like, the obliging waiter or the personal financial advisor, if you've got one of them, or the telephone banking assistant. That's his job, after all. He's God, isn't he? On day before yesterday, I was heading down to the West Country on a train, and one of my fellow passengers left his copy of The Sun on the seat beside me. You may have seen Friday. I'm sure you didn't, but you may have seen Friday's Sun. It had a picture of Des Lynam kneeling on the front, and he was kneeling on his Sun prayer mat. I don't know. I was so intrigued that I picked it up. I wouldn't normally do a thing like this. But they actually reproduced the Sun prayer mat. I don't know if you saw it like that. A picture of Wembley with the George Cross in the middle. And the idea was that you point it towards your television, like television set like this on Friday night. It has a place for the left knee here, the right knee there, and the beer mat at the top on the right. And of course, and it says directions for use. If England look in trouble, get down on your knees. Place beer in the area provided and pray. Now, I know that is a ridiculous illustration. It's meant to be tongue-in-cheek. But if you were to do a street survey, you'd find that the vast number of our society today have that kind of view about God really deep at heart. Oh, he's there, on hand, ready to solve our problems when we need him. Certainly that was the way I viewed God when I started, before I ever started to read the Bible. I never gave him the time of day. I never thought of him except in a crisis. But at the end of the day, he was with me. He would go with me. That's part of his job description. He's God. And when you have to take funerals, like I do, a desperately sad part of this job, that's the assumption of nearly everybody as a relative dies. Grandpa lived a decent life. He never did anybody harm. He may not have paid a blind bit of attention to God in his life on this earth, but, well, he's safe in the room next door. He's at rest, at peace. But do you see verse 3 of our reading on page 92, Exodus 33, verse 3, completely contradicts that. God speaking. go up to the land flowing with milk and honey, but I will not go with you because you're a stiff-necked people and I might destroy you on the way. Two negative statements then in that verse. And they speak both about the problem of the human heart and about the purity of the heart of God. So the first, the problem of the human heart. And right away, if you've got your Bible open, you can see that I've been somewhat physiologically challenged, because the verse actually doesn't talk about the heart, it talks about the neck. And so you'll forgive me, I hope, for bending the title slightly this evening. I thought the neck of the matter wouldn't quite sound right, and Joan Bakewell didn't either. And so we're in the language of stiff necks, not hard heart, but never mind. And the idea of a stiff neck has an agricultural background. So if you were ploughing or driving your cart and you had a particularly obstinate beast or an obtuse animal in front of you that refused to pay attention, you would call it a stiff-necked brute. As I said earlier, I used to live on a farm. My little sister had a small pony called Wellington, and whether he had a rider or not, he used to roll every time he came near water. In a county of high rainfall, it was somewhat disconcerting for my sister and hilarious for the rest of us. But apart from that, Wellington was incorrigibly idle. And on the way out from the farm, if you were ever going riding, he would always be looking to turn back to left or right. When you got to the end point and you started heading back in the direction of home, well, then he would be impossible to stop. No matter how you yanked his head or whatever, he would not yield to instruction. He was stiff-necked. See the kind of language? The interesting thing is that this verse in verse 3 is written to God's people, and it's God's assessment of the character and behavior of his own people. He says, we are characteristically stiff-necked. We won't yield to God's instruction or direction. We are stubborn and unbending. No matter how clearly God gives the instruction, we are too proud to obey. Now, my feeling is that my suspicion is that probably every one of us in the building this evening must surely be honest enough to admit that this diagnosis is true of us individually. If it's true of those who already claim to belong to God, well, surely it must be true of those who would not yet say they belong to God. And so I don't want to dwell too long on this point, because I think it is self-evidently clear to us when we stop and examine our lives that we are stiff-necked when it comes to the subject of God. Let's just take the issue of treating God as God. I surely you're no different to me in this matter. You don't treat him as he ought to be treated. And don't you find, rather than giving him your first love and your primary thought and your best energy, which surely he ought to have if he's God, don't you find that he so frequently ranks somewhere down amongst the also-rans in your list of priorities? Just turn back a couple of pages to chapter 20. I think it's on page 77. God spoke all these words to his people. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You are to have no other gods before me. You are to have no other gods before my face. See, these words are written to God's people. And he tells them in verse 3, doesn't he, that they're to have no other gods before him. That is, nothing else is to take his place as the number one concern in our energy, time, and love. He is God. We're not to give our first love to anybody else or anything else. Now, as I say, this surely is a self-evident point. None of us in this building could possibly stand here and say, I guess, that we have loved the Lord God our Creator with all our heart, all our mind, all our soul, all our strength. For many, it's our career that has edged into first place in our concerns and passion. So our energy is absorbed by our boss or the exam results. For others, it's a relationship. And we feel that the relationship will provide us with security and purpose and future happiness. And so that absorbs all our energy and all our concern. For others, maybe it's image or physique for some, or possibly for others, the state and success of the English football team. As I say, we're not going to spend too long on this, but suffice it to say that surely we must acknowledge that we don't give him first priority. We don't consult him frequently, except in extremis. We don't live the way he wants us to live. We push him back into the secret corner of our lives, treating him like the telephone banking assistant, or the waiter, or the AA man, the fifth or fourth or whichever one it is, emergency service, ready to call. I know a man who can, but let's not have him as God and ruler over my life, absorbing all my concern and energy and passion. We are stiff-necked. But let's be frank about this, because on its own, I think this assessment need not change our original presupposition that God is still with every one of us. See, after all, somebody might say, and want to say, well, fine, nobody in this building would fail for one second to agree with the fact that all of us are far from perfect. Nobody can be without fault all the time. We're only human, after all. None of us is a super saint. Surely God is still with us. Well, let's move on now from the problem of the human heart to the purity of the heart of God. And that comes again in our verse, in verse 3. Go up to this land flowing with milk and honey, but I will not go with you because you're a stiff-necked people. We're on page 92 here. I will not go with you because you're a stiff-necked people and I might destroy you on the way. So this verse touches on a key characteristic of the Christian God. That at the heart of the God of the Bible, the one true creator God, is a passionate purity that burns against all wickedness of any sort. When we come to God and his teaching about himself, we find ourselves meeting one with one who is passionate in his purity. I don't know if you've ever been into one of those kitchens that has those industrial fly zappers in it. And, you know, there's ghastly noises which come, torturous noises that come from it. I don't know what kind of a light they have in it behind that cage. Whatever it is, it's quite clear that anything passing that happens to nip in to pay a visit, the light is so pure and so intense and so penetrating that it simply cannot mix with any of these beetles or flies or moths or small children or whatever it happens to be. Well, now, God's purity, God's holiness is such that he is unable to mix with any wickedness and any evil of any sort. So there it is in verse 3. Go up, but I will not go with you because you're a stiff-necked people and I might destroy you on the way. It's there in verse 5 too. He says it again just in case we didn't get it. The Lord said to Israel, tell the Israelites you're a stiff-necked, he said to Moses, tell the Israelites you're a stiff-necked people. If I were to go with you, even for a moment, I might destroy you. So God's purity and holiness is such that he is unable to mix with any wickedness of whatever sort. So do you see that when we come to God's words in the Bible about himself to tell us what he is really like, our presuppositions about God immediately begin to be challenged, don't they? And I guess it's easy, if we have never thought about the nature and the character of God, for us to recoil from this aspect of his character. Why, only yesterday at a wedding supper, a woman suggested that I was narrow and bigoted for holding to this view about the character, the pure, perfect character of God. But I want to ask you, as I asked her, to think for a moment about God's anger and purity. See, if God's anger and his purity did not burn passionately against all wickedness of whatever sort, I would suggest that you, along with her, would be the first to complain. See, all of us are rightly horrified, aren't we, when a French policeman is clubbed into a coma with a metal peg. All of us rightly want Billy Joe's killer, whoever he or she might be, to meet with justice. We are adamant that the murderers of Stephen Lawrence ought to be brought to book. We are horrified at the atrocities committed in Jakarta. Now, if God's anger did not burn passionately against all wickedness of whatever sort, well, just what kind of a God would he be? Well, ugly, heartless, capricious. I, for one, would be ashamed to call myself a follower of his. But you see, gloriously, the truth of the matter is, as we come to look at the true God, the God of the Bible as he reveals himself to us, we find that his anger burns passionately against all wickedness of whatever sort. Let's have a look at that verse again. Verse 3. Go up to the land flowing with milk and honey, but I will not go with you because you are a stiff-necked people and I might destroy you on the way. So when we come to God's words about himself, we find that at his heart is an absolute, pure, perfect, passionate holiness. Like oil and water, or light and darkness, or fire and straw. He simply cannot mix with the guilty rebel. God's pure anger burns against wickedness of any sort. Take the pure and perfect anger away from God, like this woman at supper last night, and you're left with some kind of a monster. Leave the pure and perfect anger in the heart of God, and, well, we've got a real problem with the human heart. Now, I guess we could leave the evening here at this stage. It'd be pretty depressing, wouldn't it? There's the problem. Maybe you came in this evening thinking along the lines we outlined in the first few minutes of the talk. Well, I may not be perfect. I may not give God a second thought. I may not be a saint. But, well, at the end of the day, God will just sweep me in along with everybody else. That's his job, isn't it? But we've seen that God tells us that it isn't an automatic thing for him to sweep everybody into heaven. Indeed, his pure and perfect anger rightly must burn against wickedness of any sort. We've seen that we're far from perfect. And that must mean that you and I, with our imperfect lives, stand before God condemned and separate. But simply to leave the evening here would be to ignore the whole plot and purpose of the whole of the Bible and all of God's actions in history. And it would be to ignore the heart of the plot and purpose of God, the loving faithfulness and undeserved kindness of God that is expressed to us in his sending Jesus Christ to his earth. So to cut a long story short, I want us to move forward to page 1207. To some verses in the New Testament, which are actually a commentary on the chapters in the book of Exodus on page 92 that we've just been looking at. So we're not just plucking random verses here. These verses in Hebrews chapter 9 are actually a commentary on the passage that we've just been looking at. And as we look at chapter 9 verse 28, we're going to see that the death of Jesus, God's Son, who he sent into the world because of his love for us, the death of Jesus both satisfies the purity of the heart of God and cleanses the problem of our heart. So, chapter 9, verse 28. Verse 27. Just as man is destined to die once and after that to face judgment, there is God's anger, so Christ was sacrificed once to take away the sins of many people. Now, at the heart of that idea, this idea of sacrifice on behalf of many people, is the idea of substitution. And it's gloriously appropriate that I don't have to spend a lot of time talking about substitution because it's so fresh in our mind. Remember the Romanian match and that dreadful moment when Paul Ince fell to the ground clasping his left ankle? Well, only a few moments as he hobbled late off the pitch, there was David Beckham, who is my mother's pin-up. Is David Beckham your mother's pin-up? It's extraordinary, isn't it? Either David Beckham or David Owen has become the pin-up of all over 60-year-olds in England for some extraordinary reason, but anyway, he is. And he came bounding on to his place, the cheers from mother delight around the telly. One was rendered unable to perform the task necessary. Ince. Another, like him, more able, perfectly suitable, fully qualified, fit for the task, stepped into his place. Now, this idea of substitution is the leading concept behind the everlasting and loving plan of our heavenly God to bring together a group of people into relationship with him. It's this concept, this idea, and this concept alone that explains the life and the death and the mission of his one and only Son, Jesus Christ. It's this idea of substitution and this idea of substitution alone that makes sense of the passage we were looking at in Exodus chapter 33, and the passage we're looking at here that talks about sacrifice in Hebrews 9. God so loved the world, he had such compassion for our helpless, stiff-necked situation, that he sent his one and only Son, Jesus Christ, who came fully human, fully God, who lived a perfect life, who was fully qualified, who had no sin of his own that God should be angry at, who didn't deserve to face the pure and passionate anger of God. And this unblemished Jesus Christ stepped into our place to face the Father's anger, to absorb it in full, so that we could step free. He went to his death on a cross in first century Palestine, in our place, as a substitutionary sacrifice, to die a death that you and I deserve because of our stiff necks and hard hearts. And once we understand this idea of substitution, which lies at the whole heart of God's dealings with men and women, once we understand this idea that the unblemished, perfect Son of God was facing the anger of God on the cross, then these words in Hebrews 9 begin to make sense. Just have a look at the verse again, you see. Christ, verse 28, was sacrificed once to take away the sins of many people. He went to the cross in our place to deal with our sin. Look at verse 14 of chapter 9, just across the column. How much more then will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself unblemished to God, cleanse our consciences, our hearts, from acts that lead to death? Turn over to chapter 10, verse 10. By that will we have been made holy through the sacrifice of the body of Jesus Christ once for all. Now, do you see the point? I remember on December the 17th, 1979, when I first began to grasp this point. Friendship with God, relationship with God, is what this sacrifice is all about. It's what the Christian message is all about. It's not about ritual and religion. It's not about rules and regulations. It is about a pure, free, loving relationship with a loving God who has stepped into history to deal with the problem of our heart by the death of his Son. Such a relationship is only possible where the passionate and burning purity of God's heart has been dealt with. I don't know if you remember the great forest fires in Indonesia and Asia, or the vast blaze outside Sydney a couple of years ago. The story is told of some trippers who rather bravely trekked out into the bush and across the charred remains of the jungle. And one of them stopped and called to the others around him. He'd spotted a burned and shriveled remains of some forest bird lying on the forest floor. The fire had obviously raged past and caught it nestling there on the ground. And as they turned to go, one of the lads reached out his walking stick and just lifted this carcass up. To their amazement, as he lifted it, there underneath were five completely unscathed chicks, hungry, bewildered, perfectly safe. And you see what had happened. Unable to escape, the loving mother had obviously taken the decision to shelter the one she loved under the shadow of her wing. The fire had raged by. She'd absorbed the intensity of it. And those that had sheltered under her had stepped free to enjoy life. Well, the Lord Jesus Christ, sent by the loving Father in heaven, was sacrificed once to take away the sins of many people. He died a substitutionary death in our place, so that the passionate purity of the heart of God, which burns against our rebellion, might be satisfied. His death enables those of us who take shelter under him to walk free in relationship with a loving God. Well, the question then, obviously, we have to finish with on an evening like this evening is, will you? Will you turn to God and enter into a relationship like that? Have you done it? Have you taken advantage of it? I think I said I used to be in the army, and one of the things that our instructors used to do with us at Sandhurst was to march us as a body of men towards the walls of the parade ground, or towards Bin Brook, which was a river. As we approached, he would leave the moment at which he gave the order to do the about turn until the very last moment. It was a great game as far as he was concerned, and he never failed, fortunately. But here he was, marching us towards the river, the brick wall, heading for certain direction, disaster. Then as disaster appeared to be certain, so he would call out the words of command, about turn. The whole body of men would turn around, face in an opposite direction, and head away from danger to safety. Well, here is the heart of the Christian faith. It lies in a command by God our Father to turn about. God's diagnosis of our condition is there. It's a problem with our human heart. We are stiff-necked. The problem is made absolute by the purity of the heart of God. We'd have him no other way, would we? But the purity of his heart means that his anger must burn against the wickedness and the problem of our heart. But he has made a way possible for his purity and his anger to be satisfied by the substitutionary death of his son. And he calls out a word of command to every individual down through the centuries who listen to him. Don't go on being stiff-necked. Turn around. Turn back to the loving Father. It is possible to enter into a relationship with him. If we go on heading in our own direction this way, well, certain disaster, because the anger will burn against us for eternity at our refusal to listen to him and obey him. But if we turn around and take advantage of his offer of love, so he offers us free and open relationship. And I guess there'll be some here this evening who have never listened or obeyed that command. Well, for some, tonight would not be the night. You don't know enough about this Christian message and about Jesus to be able to turn around. For some, tonight will be a good night to do it, and you will know that for yourself if it is you. And if that is you, then why not come and see me at the end of the evening? I've got some excellent little booklets here which will be a terrific help to you, and I'll be able to talk to you about how it is that you turn about and take advantage of the loving offer of a loving Father.